David Glasgow Farragut. The possibilities of American life are strikingly illustrated by the fact that the two names at the head of the Army and Navy, Grant and Farragut, represent self-made men. The latter was born on a farm near Knoxville, Tennessee, July 5, 1801. His mother, of Scotch descent, was a brave and energetic woman. Once, when the father was absent in the Indian Wars, the savages came to their plain home and demanded admittance. She barred the door as best she could, and sending her trembling children into the loft, guarded the entrance with an axe. The Indians thought discretion the better part of valor, and stole quietly away. When David was 7 years old, the family, having moved to New Orleans, as the father had been appointed sailing master in the Navy, the noble mother died of yellow fever, leaving 5 children, the youngest an infant. This was a most severe blow. Fortunately, soon after, an act of kindness brought its reward. The father of Commodore Porter having died at the Farragut house, the son determined to adopt one of the motherless children, if one was willing to leave his home. Little David was pleased with the uniform and said promptly that he would go. Saying goodbye forever to his father, he was taken to Washington and, after a few months spent in school, at the age of 9 years and a half, was made a midshipman, and now began a life full of hardship, of adventure, and of brave deeds, which have added luster to the American Navy and have made the name of Farragut immortal. His first cruise was along the coast in the Essex, after the War of 1812 with Great Britain had begun. They had captured the Alert and other prizes, and their ship was crowded with prisoners. One night, when the boy lay apparently asleep, the coxswain of the Alert came to his hammock, pistol in hand. David lay motionless till he passed on, and then crept noiselessly to the cabin and informed Captain Porter. Springing from his cot, he shouted, "Fire! Fire!" The seamen rushed on deck, and the mutineers were in irons before they had recovered from their amazement. Evidently, the boy had inherited some of his mother's fearlessness. His second cruise was in the Pacific Ocean, where they encountered a fearful storm going round Cape Horn. An accident occurred at this time which showed the mettle of the lad. Though only 12, he was ordered by Captain Porter to take a prize vessel to Valparaiso, the captured captain being required to navigate it. When David requested that the main topsail be filled away, the captain replied that he would shoot any man who dared to touch a rope without his orders, and then went below for his pistols. David called one of the crew, told him what had happened and what he wanted done. "Aye, aye, sir," responded the faithful sailor as he began to execute the orders. The young midshipman at once sent word to the captain not to come on deck with his pistols unless he wished to go overboard. From that moment, the boy was master of the vessel and admired for his bravery. The following year, 1814, while the Essex was off the coast of Chile, she was attacked by the British ships Phoebe and Cherub. The battle lasted for 2 hours and a half, the Phoebe throwing 718-pound shots at the Essex. "I shall never forget," Farragut said years after, "the horrid impression made upon me at the sight of the first man I had ever seen killed. It staggered and sickened me at first, but they soon began to fall so fast that it all appeared like a dream and produced no effect upon my nerves. Soon after this, some gun primers were wanted, and I was sent after them. In going below, while I was on the wardroom ladder, the captain of the gun directly opposite the hatchway was struck full in the face by an 18-pound shot and fell back on me. We tumbled down the hatch together. I lay for some moments stunned by the blow, but soon recovered consciousness enough to rush up on deck. The captain, seeing me covered with blood, asked if I was wounded, to which I replied, 'I believe not, sir.' 'Then,' said he, 'where are the primers?' This brought me completely to my senses, and I ran below again and carried the primers on deck. When Porter had been forced to surrender, David went below to help the surgeon in dressing wounds. One brave young man, Lieutenant Cowell, said, 'Oh, Davy, I fear it is all up with me.' He could have been saved had his leg been amputated an hour sooner, but when it was proposed to drop another patient and attend to him, he said, "No, doctor, none of that. Fair play is a jewel. One man's life is as dear as another's. I would not cheat any poor fellow out of his turn." Many brave men died, saying, "Don't give her up. Hurrah for liberty." One young Scotchman, whose leg had been shot off, said to his comrades, "I left my own country and adopted the United States to fight for her. I hope I have this day proved myself worthy of the country of my adoption. I am no longer of any use to you or to her. So, goodbye," saying which he threw himself overboard. When David was taken a prisoner on board the Phoebe, he could not refrain from tears of mortification. "Never mind, my little fellow," said the captain. "It will be your turn next, perhaps." "I hope so," was the reply. Soon David's pet pig Murphy was brought on board, and he immediately claimed it. "But," said the English sailor, "you are a prisoner, and your pig also." "We always respect private property," the boy replied, seizing hold of Murphy, and after a vigorous fight, the pet was given to its owner. On returning to Captain Porter's house at Chester, Pennsylvania, David was put at school for the summer under a quaint instructor, one of Napoleon's celebrated guard, who used no book, but taught the boys about plants and minerals and how to climb and swim. In the fall, he was placed on a receiving ship, but gladly left the wild set of lads for a cruise in the Mediterranean. Here he had the opportunity of visiting Naples, Pompeii, and other places of interest, but he encountered much that was harsh and trying. Commodore C. sometimes knocked down his own son and his son's friend as well. Not a pleasant person to be governed by. In 1817, Chaplain Folsom of their ship was appointed consul at Tunis. He loved David as a brother and begged the privilege of keeping him for a time because, said he to the commodore, he is entirely destitute of the aids of fortune and the influence of friends other than those whom his character may attach to him. For nearly 9 months he remained with the chaplain, studying French, Italian, English literature, and mathematics, and developing in manliness and refinement. The Danish consul showed great fondness for the frank, ardent boy, now 16, and invited him to his house at Carthage. Failing in his health, a horseback trip toward the interior of the country was recommended, and during the journey he received a sunstroke, and his eyes were permanently weakened. All his life, however, he had someone read to him and thus mitigate his misfortune. The time came to go back to duty on the ship, and Chaplain Folsom clasped the big boy to his bosom, fervently kissing him on each cheek and giving him his parting blessing mingled with his tears. 40 years after, when the young midshipman had become the famous admiral, he sent a token of respect and affection to his old friend. For some years, having been appointed acting lieutenant, he cruised in the Gulf of Mexico, gaining knowledge which he was glad to use later, and in the West Indies, where for 2.5 years, he says, "I never owned a bed, but lay down to rest wherever I found the most comfortable berth." Sometimes he and his seamen pursued pirates who infested the coast, cutting their way through thorn bushes and cactus plants with their cutlasses, then burning the houses of these robbers and taking their plunder out of their caves. It was an exciting but wearing life. After a visit to his old home at New Orleans, his father had died and his sister did not recognize him. He contracted yellow fever and lay ill for some time in a Washington hospital. Perhaps the sailor was tired of his roving and somewhat lonely life, and now married at 22, Miss Susan Marchant, of Norfolk, Virginia. For 16 years she was an invalid, so that he carried her often in his arms like a child. Now he took her to New Haven for treatment, and improved what time he could spare by attending Professor Silliman's lectures at Yale College. Now he conducted a school on a receiving ship, so as to have her with him. "She bore the sickness with unparalleled resignation and patience," says Farragut in his journal. affording a beautiful example of calmness and fortitude. One of her friends in Norfolk said, "When Captain Farragut dies, he should have a monument reaching to the skies, made by every wife in the city contributing a stone to it. How the world admires a brave man with a tender heart." Farragut was now nearly 40 years of age, never pushing himself forward. Honors had come slowly. 3 years later, having been made commandant, he married Miss Virginia Royale, also of Norfolk, Virginia. At the beginning of the Mexican War, he offered his services to the government, but from indifference or the jealousy of officials, he was not called upon. The next 12 years were spent partly in the Norfolk Navy Yard, giving weekly lectures on gunnery, preparing a book on ordnance regulations, and establishing a navy yard on the Pacific coast. Whatever he did was done thoroughly and faithfully. When asked by the Navy Department to express a preference about a position, he said, "I have no volition in the matter. Your duty is to give me orders, mine to obey. I have made it the rule of my life to ask no official favors, but to await orders and then obey them." And now came the turning point of his life. April 17, 1860, Virginia, by a vote of 88-55, seceded from the United States. The next morning, Farragut, then at Norfolk, expressed disapproval of the acts of the convention and said President Lincoln would be justified in calling for troops after the Southerners had taken forts and arsenals. He was soon informed that a person with those sentiments could not live in Norfolk. "Well, then, I can live somewhere else," was the calm reply. Returning home, he announced to his wife that he had determined to stick to the flag. "This act of mine may cause years of separation from your family, so you must decide quickly whether you will go north or remain here." She decided at once to go with him, and hastily collecting a few articles, departed that evening for Baltimore. That city was in commotion, the Massachusetts troops having had a conflict with the mob. He finally secured passage for New York on a canal boat, and with limited means rented a cottage at Hastings on the Hudson for $150 a year. He loved the South and said, "God forbid that I should have to raise my hand against her," but he was anxious to take part in the war for the Union and offered his services to that end. The government had an important project in hand. The Mississippi River was largely in the control of the Confederacy and was the great highway for transporting her supplies. New Orleans was the richest city of the South, receiving for shipment at this time $92 million worth of cotton and more than $25 million worth of sugar yearly. If this city could be captured and the river controlled by the North, the South would be seriously crippled. But the lower Mississippi was guarded by the strongest forts, Jackson and St. Philip, which mounted 115 guns and were garrisoned by 1,500 men. Above the forts were 15 vessels of the Confederate fleet, including the ironclad ram Manassas, and just below a heavy iron chain across the river bound together scores of cypress logs 30 feet long and 4 or 5 feet in diameter, thus forming an immense obstruction. Sharpshooters were stationed all along the banks. Who could be entrusted with such a formidable undertaking as the capture of this stronghold? Who sufficiently daring, skillful, and loyal? Several naval officers were considered, but Gideon Welles, Secretary of the Navy, said, "Farragut is the man." The steam sloop of war Hartford, of 1,900 tons burden and 225 feet long, was made ready as his flagship. His instructions were the certain capture of the city of New Orleans. The department and the country require of you success. If successful, you open the way to the sea for the great West, never again to be closed. The rebellion will be riven in the center, and the flag to which you have been so faithful will recover its supremacy in every state. With a grateful heart that he had been selected for the high place, and believing in his ability to win success, at 61 years of age, he started on his mission, saying, If I die in the attempt, it will only be what every officer has to expect. He who dies in doing his duty to his country and at peace with his God has played the drama of life to the best advantage. He took with him 6 sloops of war, 16 gunboats, 21 schooners, and 5 other vessels, 48 in all, the fleet carrying over 200 guns. April 18, 1862, they had all reached their positions and were ready for the struggle. For 6 days and nights, the mortars kept up a constant fire on Fort Jackson, throwing nearly 6,000 shells. Many persons were killed, but the fort did not yield. The Confederates sent down the river 5 fire rafts, flatboats filled with dry wood, smeared with tar and turpentine, hoping that these would make havoc among Farragut's ships. But his crews tossed them away to shore or let them drift out to sea. Farragut now made up his mind to pass the forts at all hazards. It was a dangerous and heroic step. If he won, New Orleans must fall. If he failed, but he must not fail. 2 gunboats were sent to cut the chain across the river. All night long, the commander watched with intense anxiety the return of the boats, which under a galling fire had succeeded in breaking the chain and thus making a passage for the fleet. At 3:30 in the morning of April 24th, the fleet was ready to start. The Cayuga led off the first division of 8 vessels. Both forts opened fire. In 10 minutes, she had passed beyond St. Philip, only to be surrounded by 11 Confederate gunboats. The Varuna came to her rescue, but was rammed by 2 Southern boats and sunk in 15 minutes. The Mississippi encountered the enemy's ram, Manassas, riddled her with shot, and set her on fire so that she drifted below the forts and blew up. Then the center division, led by the Hartford, passed into the terrific fire. First she grounded in avoiding a fire raft. Then a Confederate ram pushed a raft against her, setting her on fire. But Farragut gave his orders as calmly as though not in the utmost peril. The flames were extinguished, and she steamed on, doing terrible execution with her shells. Then came the last division, led by the Scioto and Commander Porter's gunboats. In the darkness, lighted only by the flashes of over 200 guns, the fleet had cut its way to victory, losing 184 in killed and wounded. In a twinkling, the flames had risen halfway to maintop and mizzen, darting up the shrouds like snakes. Ah, how we clanked at the brakes, and the deep steam pumps throbbed under, sending a ceaseless glow. Our topmen, a dauntless crowd, swarmed in rigging and shroud. There, 'twas a wonder, the burning ratlins and strands they quenched with their bare, hard hands. But the great guns below never silenced their thunder. At last, by backing and sounding, when we were clear of grounding, and under headway once more, the whole rebel fleet came rounding the point. If we had it before, 'twas now, from shore to shore, one long, loud, thundering roar, such crashing, splintering, and pounding, and smashing as you never heard before. But that we fought foul wrong to wreck, and to save the land we love so well, you might have deemed our long gun deck 200 feet of hell. For all above was battle, broadside and blaze and rattle, smoke and thunder alone. But down in the sick bay where our wounded and dying lay, there was scarce a sob or a moan. And at last, when the dim day broke and the sullen sun awoke, drearily blinking o'er the haze and the cannon smoke, that even such morning dulls, there were 13 traitor hulls on fire and sinking. Henry Howard Burnell. Thus, says the son of Farragut in his admiral biography, was accomplished a feat in naval warfare which had no precedent, and which is still without a parallel, except the one furnished by Farragut himself 2 years later at Mobile. Starting with 17 wooden vessels, he had passed with all but 3 of them against the swift current of a river but 1/2 mile wide, between 2 powerful earthworks which had long been prepared for him, his course impeded by blazing rafts, and immediately thereafter had met the enemy's fleet of 15 vessels, two of them ironclads, and either captured or destroyed every one of them, and all this with the loss of but one ship from his squadron. The following day he wrote, "My dearest wife and boy, I am so agitated that I can scarcely write, and shall only tell you that it has pleased Almighty God to preserve my life through a fire such as the world has scarcely known. He has permitted me to make a name for my dear boy's inheritance, as well as for my comfort and that of my family." The next day at 11 o'clock in the morning, by order of Farragut, the officers and crews of the fleet returned thanks to Almighty God for his great goodness and mercy in permitting us to pass through the events of the last 2 days with so little loss of life and blood. April 29, a battalion of 250 Marines and 2 howitzers, manned by sailors from the Hartford, marched through the streets of New Orleans, hoisted the Union flag in place of the Confederate on the City Hall, and held possession till General Butler arrived with his troops on May 1st. After the fall of the city, the forts were surrendered to Porter. From here, Farragut went to Vicksburg with 16 vessels, the Hartford, he says, like an old hen taking care of her chickens, and passing the batteries with 15 killed and 30 wounded. 3 months later, he received the thanks of Congress on parchment for the gallant services of himself and his men, and was made Rear Admiral. He remained on the river and Gulf for some months, doing effective work in sustaining the blockade and destroying the salt works along the coast. When the memorable passage of the batteries at Port Hudson was made, where 113 were killed or wounded, the Hartford taking the lead, his idolized boy, Loyal, standing beside him. When urged by the surgeon to let his son go below to help with the wounded, because it was safer, he replied, "No, that will not do. It is true our only child is on board by chance, and he is not in the service, but being here, he will act as one of my aides to assist in conveying my orders during the battle, and we will trust in Providence." Neither would the lad listen to the suggestion, for he wanted to be stationed on deck and see the fight. Farragut soon sent him back to his mother, for he said, "I'm too devoted a father to have my son with me in troubles of this kind. The anxieties of a father should not be added to those of a commander." Every day was full of exciting incident. The admiral, needing some dispatches taken down the river, his secretary, Mr. Gobadon, volunteered to bear the message. A small dugout was covered with twigs so as to resemble floating trees. At night he lay down in his little craft, with paddle and pistol by his side, and drifted with the current. Once a Confederate boat pulled out into the stream to investigate the somewhat large tree, but returned to report that it was only a log. He succeeded in reaching General Banks, who had taken the place of General Butler, and when the fleet returned to New Orleans, he was warmly welcomed on board by his admiring companions. Farragut now returned to New York for a short time, where all were anxious to meet the hero of New Orleans, and to see the historic Hartford, which had been struck 240 times by shot and shell in 19 months' service. The Union League Club presented him a beautiful sword, the scabbard of gold and silver, and the hilt set in brilliants. His next point of attack was Mobile Bay. Under cover of the forts, Morgan, Gaines, and Powell, the blockade was finally broken. A good story is told of the capture of one of these vessels, whose merchant captain was brought before Farragut. He proved to be an old acquaintance, who said he was bound for Matamoras on the Rio Grande. The admiral expressed amazement that he should be 300 miles out of his court, and said good-naturedly, "I am sorry for you, but we shall have to hold you for your thundering bad navigation." And now occurred the most brilliant battle of his career. August 4th, 1864, he wrote to his wife, "I am going into Mobile Bay in the morning. If God is my leader, as I hope he is, and in him I place my trust. God bless and preserve you, my darling, and my dear boy, if anything should happen to me. Your devoted and affectionate husband, who never for one moment forgot his love duty, or fidelity to you, his devoted and best of wives. At 5:30 in the morning of August 5th, 14 ships and 4 monitors, headed by the Brooklyn, because she had apparatus for picking up torpedoes, moved into action. Very soon, the Tecumseh, the monitor abreast of the Brooklyn, went down with nearly every soul on board, sunk by a torpedo. When the Brooklyn saw this disaster, she began to back. "What's the trouble?" was shouted through the trumpet. "Torpedoes!" The supreme moment had come for decision. The grand old admiral offered up this prayer in his heart. "Oh God, direct me what to do. Shall I go on?" And a voice seemed to answer, "Go on." "Go ahead," he shouted to his captain on the Hartford. "Give her all the steam you've got." And like a thing of life, she swept on over the torpedoes to the head of the fleet, where she became the special target of the enemy. Her timbers crashed, and her wounded came pouring down, cries never to be forgotten. Twice the brave admiral was lashed to the rigging by his devoted men, lest in his exposed position he fall overboard if struck by a ball. The fleet lost 335 men, but Farragut gained the day. When all was over and he looked upon the dead laid out on the port side of his ship, he wept like a child. The prisoners captured in the defenses of Mobile were 1,464, with 104 guns. On his return to New York, he was welcomed with the grandest demonstrations. Crowds gathered at the battery, a public reception was given him at the Custom House, and $50,000 with which to buy a house in New York. Congress made him vice admiral. Prominent politicians asked him to become a candidate for the presidency, but he refused, saying, "I have no ambition for anything but what I am, an admiral. I have worked hard for 3 years, have been in 11 fights, and am willing to fight 11 more if necessary. But when I go home, I desire peace and comfort." At Hastings on the Hudson, the streets were arched with the words New Orleans, Mobile, Jackson, St. Philip, etc. Boston gave him a welcome reception at Fenway Hall, Oliver Wendell Holmes reading a poem on the occasion. At Cambridge, 200 Harvard students took his horses from the carriage and, attaching ropes to it, drew him through the streets. On July 25th, 1866, the rank of admiral was created by Congress, and Farragut was appointed to the place. Honors and well-deserved ones had come at last to the brave midshipman. The next year, in command of the European squadron, accompanied by Mrs. Farragut, who went by special permission of the president, he visited France, Russia, and other countries. Napoleon III welcomed him to the Tuileries. The Grand Duke Constantine of Russia, Duke of Edinburgh, and Victor Emmanuel each made him their guest. He dined with the King of Denmark and the King of Greece, and Queen Victoria received him at the Osborne House. 2 years later, he visited the Navy Yard on the Pacific coast, which he had established years before. He died August 14, 1870, at the age of 69, universally honored and regretted. Congress appropriated $20,000 for his statue on Farragut Square, Washington, and the work has been executed by Vinnie Ream Hoxie. Success was not an accident with the Christian admiral. It was the result of devotion to duty, real bravery, and a life distinguished by purity of character and the highest sense of honor.